I'll invite you to turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 21. We will only be here briefly before we'll go back to the Old Testament, as we've been mentioning. We're spending a lot of time in the Old Testament, but the reason we're doing that is to both help us see our Savior Jesus there, but also ourselves, that we can learn a lot about our purpose as Christians by seeing the things that prophetically and historically foreshadowed not only our Savior, but ourselves. Now, the reason I want to start here in Luke 21 is I want to use this passage to say something about this congregation, but also to introduce the lesson. So, Luke 21, verse 1. And Jesus looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury, and he saw a poor widow putting in two small copper coins. And he said, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of them. For they all, out of their surplus, put into the offering, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had to live on. And while some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, he said, 'As for these things which you are looking at, the days will come in which there will not be left one stone upon another, which will not be torn down.'" You know, one of the things Jesus was really good at that I'd like to get better about is he saw things that other people didn't see. He noticed things that other people overlooked. Have you ever noticed how in this passage that we just read, there's a difference between what Jesus was looking at in the temple, and then look at there in verse 6, Jesus said to them, "As for these things you are looking at," they're looking at the beautiful stones and the buildings. But Jesus noticed this woman doing something that had eternal significance, while these flashy things were just temporary things. How does that introduce this congregation? So when I was asked to come here, I didn't even know where Canton, Illinois was. I still don't know where Canton, Illinois is. I'm somebody who can sometimes be a little bit enamored with flashy things. You know, you hear the name of some famous preacher and you think, "Oh, that's going to be somebody I'm going to learn a lot from." And then you come to a place, it's kind of a spot on the map, and you meet people who love God deeply. Never heard your names, but I've just been encouraged. You know what I just want to say to a group like this? Humble church, maybe not well known beyond these walls. You can learn a lot from paying attention to the faithful among you. More than any preacher that ever comes through here, whether his name is great. And you learn to see the things that God sometimes notices that other people don't. So I'll be encouraged by you this week for that reason. But I'll tell you how this introduces our Bible story. We're going to go back to 1 Samuel 25. And we're going to talk about a Bible character that is largely overshadowed by the bigger characters around her. We're going to talk about a woman named Abigail. But a lot of people don't even know Abigail's story. Many people that do are usually women who had a Bible study about this woman. But she's overshadowed by David. This is the chapter where Samuel dies. Sometimes even her foolish husband Nabal gets a little bit more attention. But God decided to spend the whole chapter telling the story of this wonderful woman so that we could learn something about, I'm going to suggest, Jesus and the church. I titled this sermon, Abigail's Shadow, because I believe with all my heart that she is a foreshadowing of Jesus himself. It's rare in the Old Testament to have a woman foreshadow the Messiah, but I hope I'll make my case by the time we're done. But I also think she's a foreshadowing of the bride of Christ, or the church. And hopefully by the time we're done, you'll see that as well. But let's tell this woman's story. 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 1 says, "Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran." Now, David's introduced here. He's gone to the wilderness. I want to remind you of the lesson yesterday. Back in chapter 22, we are told that 400 men came to be with David. He became the captain of a 400, I call them the 3D army. Remember, they were in debt and distressed and discontent. A bunch of losers were running around with David out there in the wilderness. Chapter 23, verse 13, tells us that army grew to 650. So now you have David with 650 ne'er-do-wells out there in the wilderness. And we're going to find out that what he's decided to do is use them to protect Israel. He's kind of policing the area, making sure cattle rustlers don't come up and steal people's goods. But he's doing as much good as he can with this band of misfits. Let's keep reading and see what happens here. Verse 2 says, "Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. That David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, 'Go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name, and thus you shall say to him, Have a long life. Peace be to you. Peace be to your house. Peace be to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us. We have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we've come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servant and to your son, David.'" All right, let's work back through that. We're introduced not only to David, but to a man named Nabal. Does anybody remember what his name means? Later on in the story, Abigail will say his name and basically say, "As his name is, so is he. He is a fool." Nabal was a fool. But he was a rich fool, I guess. I'm not familiar with measuring wealth this way. I don't even have one goat, but he had a bunch. So it says he's very rich. He's very successful. And then we're introduced to his wife. Now, he's described as being harsh and evil, but Abigail, whose name means joy of the father or a father's joy, she's described as intelligent and beautiful. I don't know if that strikes anybody. The Bible's pretty clear that she was what some people call the whole package, right? When I was growing up, every once in a while, a girl would be interested in me, and she'd say something like this: "Well, I think you're cute, but I really don't like to talk to you much. You can be good looking and not that intelligent to some." Or there were those that said, "I like to talk to you, but I can't look at you for very long." Like Abigail is described as being all of that. Me and my Bible friend nerds, when we were teenagers, we'd always say, like, if you could go back into the Bible and you could pick one girl, who would it be? And it always came down to Abigail or Abishag. You remember that girl? She was so beautiful, men killed for her. But most of us always picked Abigail. Now, that may sound like a funny thing to mention, but it's going to have a purpose in this lesson. I want you to notice how different the husband and wife are. So, David finds out that there's this festive thing going on down at Nabal's house. It's probably after the winter. You've got springtime coming on. The sheep come down from the mountains. He's shearing the sheep. He's gathering in the winter harvest. And David sends these young men to ask a favor of Nabal. I want you to notice how kind David is in the request. He says, "Shalom, shalom, shalom, peace be to you, peace be to your house. I know what's going on down here. I've sent my young men and I've greeted you in my name." Keep that in mind. They come in the name of David. And everybody knew who David was, including Nabal. Now, this is not an unreasonable request. Number one, David says, "We've offered you a service. Like, we've kept you safe. You haven't missed anything. Every head of cattle, all of your sheep are accounted for. We didn't mistreat any of your guys. Ask them, they'll tell you. We're just asking for a little bit of help here. But it's not just that it was fair. It's that the law of Moses actually told the rich that they were supposed to think about the poor. Remember, they were told when they harvested their land to keep the corners unharvested so the poor could come in and gather grain. So this isn't an unreasonable thing for David to request here. But watch what happens when he gets to Nabal's house, the ten young men in verse 9. When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name. Then they waited. Can you picture that? These 10 young men ride up. They say all those kind things to Nabal. And the Bible just says they waited. How long? 5 minutes? 5 hours? A whole day? I don't know how long that was, but it's awkward, isn't it? Have you ever tried to talk to somebody and they just ignored you? You try to say something kind and they just pretend like you're not there. Nabal just acts like these fellows aren't here, maybe trying to formulate how he's going to respond to them. Watch what he says when he finally speaks up in verse 10. But Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I've slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I do not know?" So David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and told him according to all these words. Stop there. When Nabal finally speaks up, he says, "Who is David? Who's the son of Jesse?" Do you know what he doesn't mean by that? He doesn't mean, "I've never heard of him." No, he knows who he is. What he means is, "Who is he to me? Look at where he is. He's out here in the wilderness with all of you losers who are breaking away from their masters. You want me to take my money, what I've earned, what I've worked hard for, and share it with a bunch of guys, and I don't even know what your origin is?" Not a chance. I'll tell you something about this text. I struggle with this text because I understand that response. I grew up in San Diego, California. If I'm ever homeless, I'll tell you guys where to find me. San Diego, California is a great place to live. You can live outside and people will give you money. And there's all kinds of people all the time out there asking for money. Let me tell you, growing up, how I usually responded or thought in my head when I saw somebody with their hand out. I usually thought something like this: "You want me to take my money that I worked hard for and give it to somebody whose origin I do not know? There's a bunch of losers out here running around looking for a handout." It's American, isn't it? I want to remind you of something. If you think like that, that's the spirit of Nabal. You know what Jesus said? "Give to him who asks of you, expecting nothing in return." That's the spirit of Jesus. Now, to be fair, I know there's a counter argument. You got to think about wisdom. You don't want to support people in their bad behavior. I agree with all of that. All I'm simply pointing out is when Nabal, the fool, the harsh, the evil man, speaks like this, God's not pleased with this kind of attitude. And neither is David. When these guys get back and tell David what the guy said, look at verse 13. David said to his men, "Each of you gird on your sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went up behind David while 200 stayed with the baggage. Can you picture that? They come in, they tell the story, David grabs all the swords, leave a couple hundred guys here, but there's about to be a showdown at Nabal's corral, isn't there? Like, here they come for vengeance. I like the way the Bible tells stories. You know, in this particular story, you kind of switch back and forth between what's going on up at David's camp and what's going on back at Nabal's house. So look here in verse 14. Here's what's happening back home. One of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us both by night and by day, all the time we were there with them tending the sheep. Now, therefore, know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him." How bad do things have to be at that house that a servant in the house can go to the wife and say what verse 17 says? "He's such a scoundrel," your version might say. "He's so worthless that none of us can even talk to him." And that servant doesn't get in trouble. Nobody bats an eye. Everybody knows that's how much a jerk he is. There are homes like that. Did you know that? Where mom or dad or whoever in the house, everybody knows that they're unreasonable. And I just want to point something out. In this house, the servants knew who to go to if they wanted something done. This convicts me as a father. My boys growing up generally went to mom when they needed something. And I noticed that as I got a little older, as they got a little older, and I wanted to make sure that I was the kind of father that if there was something that they needed, they could come to me and not be afraid of the way I would respond. But who is it in your home that is the one who's going to know what to do and handle it well? And if you're somebody in the house that everybody avoids because you're such a scoundrel, let this lesson be important to you. Now, I like what the servant says to Abigail. He says, "Know and consider what you should do." Think about it. You're smart, Abigail. David's coming with 400 and he's coming to kill Nabal. What are you going to do? Well, here's what Abigail decides to do. Look at verse 18. "Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 jugs of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 measures of roasted grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and loaded them on donkeys. She said to her young men, 'Go on before me. Behold, I'm coming after you.' But she did not tell her husband Nabal. It came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain that, behold, David and his men were coming down toward her. So she met them. Now David had said, 'Surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave as much as 1 male of any who belong to him.'" Let's stop there for a minute. Abigail, know and consider what you should do. So what does she do? She turns into my grandma. She just starts cooking food, you know. If there's ever a problem, make food. By the way, this is brilliant, isn't it? You got 400 guys coming with swords. What do? Send them food. They can't fight with chicken legs in their hands, you know what I'm saying? Like, if they're eating, they're not fighting. But there's something else going on here. Women, I'm going to ask you about this. You're trying to appease these men that are coming. Do you think she's scared to follow the food? Ancient world, warriors. This isn't really a woman's place to go and stand in front of these men and try to speak for her husband. Do you think she feels nervous about taking her life into her own hands and coming in behind the food and bowing herself to the ground? We'll see in a minute. But that's her idea. Let's stop in the story and make a couple of observations. I'll pick up here in a second. First thing I want to point out is I really am struck by how different Abigail and Nabal are, aren't you? Have you ever seen a couple that was married and you just wondered, how did that two people get together? Like, why are they a thing? Some woman who's just sweet and kind and generous, and she's got a husband who's just a miser and a mean-spirited. By the way, it's not always that way. Have you ever met a couple where the man was gentle and generous and kind and the wife was just mean as a snake? And you wonder, how did this happen? Three options. Maybe when they got married, Abigail and Nabal were both ungodly. Sometimes people get married when they're not serving God and they're attracted to each other and they commit to each other, but they're both ungodly. But at some point in the relationship, one of them decides, I'm going to follow God. The other person never comes along. Is that a difficult situation? For sure. But at least in that situation, the person who started to follow God could say something like this. I made my bed. I have to lie in it. I knew what I was getting into. You know, that was just the way it was. Even though that relationship can be hard, maybe they can reason their way through the fact that they knew this was going to happen. Here's the second scenario. When Abigail and Nabal got married, maybe they were both godly. You ever seen that? Two people became Christians, or two people got married when they were Christians. And at some point during the marriage, one of the people said, I'm done. I'm done with God. I'm done with serving Him. I'm not going to church anymore. I'm going back to my drinking or whatever it is. Is that a difficult situation? You know what's harder about that one is a lot of times people feel like, you know, that I'm getting the raw end of the deal here. This isn't what I signed on for. You were supposed to be this person. And yet, whatever Abigail's story is, she still does what's right. In fact, I'm going to suggest Abigail's story is probably even more difficult than the first two. In those days, people got married because your parents arranged it. So in this scenario, for whatever reason, Abigail, father's joy, why did her father choose this fool? Because Abigail could have lived her whole life saying something like, this wasn't even my decision. This happened to me against my will. If you took this scenario into our modern day world, harsh, evil, jerk of a man married to a sweet, kind woman, and you said, hey, what should a woman like this do in a situation like this? What would worldly people tell you? You got to be a strong woman. You got to kick him to the curb. You got to let him go. You deserve better than this. Walk away. But God measures strength differently. Psalm 15, verse 4 says that the people that are going to dwell in God's house are those who swear to their own hurt and do not change. You know what that means? They make a commitment, and even though the commitment was difficult, they're not going to walk away just because there's some opportunity to walk away. I remember growing up, across the street from where I grew up in San Diego, there was this family. Tom was his name. He was quite successful. He had a contracting business, did a lot of great work, had a lot of money. He had a wife named Linda and a son and a daughter named Tommy and Monica. They were my age. We used to play together. At some point, Linda began to have some physical ailments, some struggles. I think it was muscular dystrophy. She ended up in a wheelchair. She ended up being unable to talk, but she had a lot of trouble in her physical life. Then Tommy and Monica, the boy and the girl, began to have trouble too. They stopped riding two-wheel bikes, started riding three-wheel bikes. We started playing baseball with a beeping ball because they couldn't see anymore. And pretty soon they were in wheelchairs as well. I was just a kid, but I remember one day we woke up and Tom, the dad, was gone. He just left. There were three sick people over there. Now, to Tom's credit, he let him keep the house. But he got himself a pretty new wife, big new truck. And he'd show up every once in a while just to make sure everything was all right at the house. And I'll tell you something, as a little boy, I couldn't stand that man. You promised. Linda's parents came and took care of all of them until they died. I don't know what your story is, but I've seen too many Christians in difficult marriages conclude that what they were going to do to get themselves out of this situation was maybe just take a step back and push their spouse toward immorality or whatever so they could get off the hook. That's not what godly people do. Psalm 31, when it speaks of the woman who's worth something, the heart of her husband safely trusts in her because she does him good, not evil, all the days of his life. So let me present it to you again. Women, Abigail was smart. Do you think she might have thought something like this when the servant says, "Abigail, know and consider what you should do. David's coming with an army to kill your husband." Do you think she could have thought something like, my, God works in mysterious ways. I think it's time to go visit my sister." That's all she had to do. Step away, walk back, let natural consequence take its place. But Abigail prepares the food, sends it ahead, follows the food, comes at the army, and watch what happens when she gets there in verse 23. "When Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed herself to the ground." Now, a couple of observations about that verse. You see, it says she hurried. Go back up to verse 18. Do you see it says she hurried? You know, one of the things that made Abigail Abigail was she didn't hesitate. When it was right, she did it, and she did it right away. She hurried and made the food. She hurried and got off her donkey, and she lays down face first in the dirt in front of David and a bunch of angry men. Now, again, I'm going to ask you women, what do you think Abigail was expecting to happen next? Do you suppose that could have been the end of her? She was going to feel a sword across the back of her neck. Was she going to get run through? I'm going to try to make my case here, but I actually believe David wanted to kill her in this moment. That David actually wanted to run her through, but he's going to say in a few moments, we'll see later in the chapter, that God kept him from doing it. But watch why. Listen to Abigail in verse 24. "She fell at his feet and said, 'On me alone, my Lord, be the blame. And please let your maidservant speak to you and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be as Nabal. Now let this gift which your maidservant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who accompany my Lord. Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant. For the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil will not be found in you all of your days. Should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord does for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and appoints you ruler over Israel, this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause and by my Lord having avenged himself. When the Lord deals well with my Lord, then remember your maid servant." What do you guys think about that speech? Her face is in the dirt, and she says all of these tremendous things. I want you to see her humility. 6 times she calls herself maidservant. 14 times she calls David Lord. And she's brilliant. You know, earlier when Nabal said, "Who is David?" Abigail knows who David is. Did you hear the Goliath reference? She speaks of David's enemies as being slung out from the hollow of a sling, almost as to remind David, "David, do you remember what you've accomplished in the past?" And she reminds him of his future. "Do you know what God's going to do with you someday? And you don't want to do this thing, David, because I care about your life, your soul, and God's plan." Those are all wonderful things. But there's two things that Abigail says that actually trouble me. I don't know if these trouble you at all, but look at verse 24 again. When Abigail says, "On me alone, my Lord, be the blame," something about that makes me upset. That's not right. Don't do that. Abigail, your husband is the one who's the bad guy. Don't go in saying, "Blame me." Don't talk like that. That's not accurate. In fact, if you think that's something, look at verse 28. This is even more crazy. Verse 28, she says, "Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant." What transgression? What had she done wrong? Remember, I told you, I believe Abigail is a type of Jesus, a foreshadowing. Long before Jesus ever stood between God's judgment and us and said, "On me be the blame, I'll take the sin," you had people like this who knew that's what love meant. That love is willing to step between the person who's done the wrong and the judgment coming to them and say, "I'll take the blame." Folks, what if life was really like that? What if in marriages, when two people fought, instead of saying, "This is all your fault," somebody could humbly say, "I know, I'm the problem." How would politics be different if all of the leaders of the land said, "That was our fault, that was our problem, that was our side of the aisle"? What would happen in churches if people understood the idea of being someone's advocate? All of the greatest people who've ever lived understood it. Moses stood between God and Israel when God was going to wipe them out in the wilderness. Moses said, "Me, not them." Abigail said, "Me, not him." Jesus said, "Me, not them." Do you think that moved David at all? The humility, the selflessness, the vision of what God was going to do, the words that this woman was pouring out in front of him. Can you imagine what's going on in the heart of David as this woman speaks? Look at verse 32. Here's David's response. David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me, and blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself by my own hand. Nevertheless, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from harming you, unless you had come quickly to meet me, surely there would not have been left to Nabal until the morning light as much as one male." So David received from her hand what she had brought him, and said to her, "Go up to your house in peace. See, I have listened to you and granted your request." All right, couple things. Did you catch there where David said, "God's restrained me from harming you"? Did you catch that? I almost picture that when she walked up, David grabbed his sword, all the men grabbed their swords, and as she began to speak, David softened and told the men, "Drop your weapons, this woman's speaking the truth." But who does David bless first in verse 32? Look at verse 32. "Blessed be God who sent you to meet me." Now, go read that story again. Did you see anywhere in the story where God miraculously appeared to Abigail and said, "Abigail, go meet David"? Did you find that anywhere? I think we're afraid to talk like this. You know, denominational people say things and we're like, "Well, we can't really talk like that. We can't give God credit about things." Folks, think about it. Whenever anyone on planet Earth does what's right, do you know why they did what's right? It wasn't their idea. I could say, "Blessed be the Lord God who sent you this night to hear me preach." Could I say that? And I don't mean anything miraculous by that. What I mean is the idea that this would be a good way to spend your time, that this would be the right thing to do with your life, that came from God. And whenever anybody does anything that's right, bless God. And then bless the other and their discernment. You know, one of the great things about this story is Abigail's the only one in the story trying to do the right thing. How many people use as an excuse for their mediocre spirituality? Well, my husband isn't doing it. The preacher isn't doing it. The church isn't doing it. The nation's not doing it. Nobody around me's doing it. Why would I be expected to be the one to take the brunt of this? But again, Abigail knows something. You know, Proverbs chapter 27, verse 17 says, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another, right? Or sometimes a woman. If not for Abigail in this occasion, David's going to sin. If not for Abigail, her family's going to die. If you find yourself in a situation where you're thinking in terms of, I'm going to excuse me not doing what's right here because, you know, the whole nation's going to pot. Remember Abigail. Verse 36. Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she did not tell him anything at all until the morning light. But in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him so that he became as a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. All right, women, I want to go back to asking you a question. You think that's been a tough day for Abigail? What do you think? She's covered in dirt from laying in the dirt. She's cried tears of fear. She had prepared all that food. She went and saved her whole family. She comes home at the end of this long day, and there's her husband drunk again. He doesn't know what she's done. He doesn't say thank you. You know what a lot of women would do? They'd go up and smack him in the back of the head and say, "Do you know what I did for you again?" You know the lesson I learned here? Doing what's right is reward enough for the person who knows that God is watching. She goes to bed that night, and I hope she slept well, knowing that God saw. There are people right now in this room who have lived lives that nobody really understands. You've had extraordinary difficulty in your marriage, in your family, in challenges, and you've never heard somebody tell you thank you that should. Your kids don't know what you went through to win them to the Lord. Your spouse doesn't know what they put you through. And they never said thanks. I want you to remember Abigail. I hope you sleep well at night. Now, I don't understand all this. Whatever this means that some days later, God strikes Nabal and his heart died within him and he became as a stone. I don't know if he had a stroke. I don't know what physical ailment came upon him. But the Bible teaches, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. Abigail does not take into her own hands to deliver herself from her own situation, but God does. Now, I am not preaching this sermon to tell you that if you wait long enough, God's going to rub out your lousy spouse. That's not why I'm preaching this. But there's an important lesson here. If you're Abigail in this story, don't give up. You keep doing what's right. No matter what that means. Because you never know what's going to come of that. 1 Peter chapter 3 tells wives who are married to unbelieving husbands, you may win them without a word. You may. Have you ever seen a woman do it? She held on, she didn't give up, and she stayed faithful. And one day, the man changed. But I want to say the other thing. If you're the Nabal in this story, if you're a child or a spouse or a friend, and people around you have been trying to show you the love of God, and you've been resistant, and you've been unkind, you better get your act together. Because the time may come where God's done with you. I had a friend growing up in San Diego. They all went to a big church. They could kind of hide there. The dad in that family was a monster. the girl that I was friends with, he would buy her drugs. She became so addicted that she ended up in a crack house. Me and my friends had to go drag her out. She'd get pregnant. Her dad would pay for her abortions. Wrecked this girl. Sometime in his 40s, I don't remember how old he was, he just didn't wake up one day. He died. And I will never forget, as long as I live, the preacher who preached that funeral said about that man, everybody knew he was unable. God dealt with him. Now, do you remember how this story ends? Abigail had actually kind of thrown out maybe like a half-hearted proposal back in verse 31. When the Lord deals well with my Lord, remember your maidservant. I don't know if she winked. I don't know if she said, hey, I'm trying to do the right thing here, but if ever you can help me out, I'm here. Well, David finds out that Nabal's dead, and he thinks to himself, well, God did the avenging, and David sends for Abigail, and Abigail comes and marries who? The king. A woman who was always meant to be the bride of a king. And in that way, Abigail's like us. Someday, if we don't give up, if we do what's right, at great cost to us, if we bear the cross like Jesus did, if we advocate for the sinners around us, if we understand that we have a place in this world, no matter how much it costs us, someday the marriage supper of the Lamb will come. I don't know what you think of this story, but Abigail is one of my favorites. I'll leave you with that last thought. Don't give up. There's a proverb that says, and I wrote it down. I want to make sure I get the right reference here. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 12 says, a hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a desire fulfilled is a tree of life. You've heard that proverb before? A hope deferred, meaning that there's something in your life that you hope for. I hope my husband will change. I hope my kids will come to the Lord. I hope this will happen or that will happen. If that hope is deferred, usually what it does is it makes your heart sick. It's hard in your life. But a desire finally fulfilled is a tree of life. There's all kinds of ways to apply that verse. For my wife and I, it was infertility. We wanted to have kids. When we first got married, it was years before we could. People kept having kids. We kept praying for them. The people that kept having kids kept saying things like, we don't want any more. And I'd pray to God and say, well, God, quit giving them to people that don't want them. We'll take them. But my heart was sick until my hope was fulfilled. And I'll tell you something, my boys are a tree of life to me. But this is the other point. For somebody who wins their spouse to the Lord finally, you seen how a tree of life that can be? Here they are finally next to him. Don't give up. Let God do his work.